From Portland, Oregon, this is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Brock Newroll. Coming up this episode, Portland synagogues are set for a summer of change as a number of long-tenured senior clergy transition into new phases of their lives. And just as businesses conduct exit interviews with outgoing employees, I've put together a series of exit interviews with those departing clergy members to get their thoughts on the past and the future of Jewish Portland. The first of these is with Rabbi David Kosak, the outgoing senior rabbi at Congregation Neve Shalom. We talked about the resurgence of religious life in America, the importance of serving the homeless, and what's next for the synagogue, the city, and for him. Stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, presenting their 105th annual meeting Thursday, June 12th at 4:30 p.m. at Congregation Neve Shalom in Portland. To learn more and to register to attend, visit jewishportland.org/annual25. Now, here's Rabbi David Kosak. Rabbi David Kosak, welcome to the Jewish Review Podcast.
Thank you very much, Rockney.
Well, so tell me about your Jewish journey.
My Jewish journey, it's a really interesting question. The phrase on its own sort of applies that we're individuals making our way in our life, which is very much the American modality, I think, of identity. Judaism is more about the collective or some balance between the two. So I start with those reflections because for me, my Jewish journey starts from my family. This is not something that I had to discover or recover. I grew up the grandson of a renowned rabbi. He lived around the corner from me. My family observed Shabbat every week. We went to synagogue. I went to Hebrew school 3 days a week. Now it's even hard to find a three-day-a-week supplemental school. We were involved in collecting cans of food or clothing and what have you for people in need. Terms of Gemilut Chasidim, the, you know, acts of kindness or tzedakah. It just was part and parcel of my life, lighting Shabbat candles. So there was no journeying. I was given an identity. I was given a legacy, an inheritance. Where my Jewish journey in a certain sense begins was in my 20s when I, like many people during what they call the journey years, actually moved entirely away from Judaism. Right?
That's the term for it, the journey years?
In sociologists, it's sort of talked about that, right? Or the journey decade. And that's because your 20s are often a period in which you've left your parental home, you've finished your schooling, and there's who am I now and what am I going to do with my life? So for me, it was in some ways moving away from that, in part because there weren't a lot of Jews where I moved anyway, and in part maybe I just also needed that distance at that point in my life. But after college, I moved to New Mexico and was focused on writing and growing a vegetable garden and hiking the beautiful mountains there. I always knew I was Jewish. It was never a question. It was, you know, hard baked into my awareness of myself, how I view myself. So my Jewish journey begins when I'm living in the Bay Area. And I feel sort of the itch or the call back, and I begin going back to services there and get involved in the Jewish community of the Bay Area in the late 80s or so, mid-80s. So then that was my journey, my Jewish journey. And apropos of this particular call, a couple of years after that, on my 30th birthday, I woke up and had an epiphany, not something Jews always talk about. It tends to occur more in other religions, yet the fact is having had conversations or opening up the door to people to feel that it's all right to mention that, lots of people have epiphanies. So there's these sudden types of awarenesses, a satori, what have you, which shift their life in some way. I woke up and I knew sort of kinesthetically with every cell in my body that I was going to be a rabbi. It was utter clarity. And that then sent me on a couple-year process, relearning or deepening the Hebrew that I knew and getting some coursework, I guess, out of the way for rabbinical school with that. And then the rest, as they say, is prologue. The future is prologue, however that phrase goes.
So for my notes as much as anything else, you have been here at Congregation Neve Shalom as senior rabbi for how many years?
The end of the contract, end of June, will be a full decade.
Mazel tov.
Thank you.
Thank you. 10 years anywhere feels like an achievement these days.
You know, it does. And it's really, I think because, you know, to be part of a religious tradition, you're tied to a calendar of sacred time and time in general and holidays. But for a lot of people, right, it's when the clock ticks over on a birthday and you go from 29 to 30. I was really into and learned about Saturn return when I was in my late 20s because everyone told me, oh, my God, your life is going to be really hard. It's going to be going crazy, you know, but, it, you know, patterns return and whatnot. So, yeah, we mark time not just in its passage, but in certain numbers that allow us to take stock and reflect.
Well, I'm turning 40 in 2 years, so I'll be having a hands-on experience with that very soon.
There you go.
What initially drew you to this congregation?
Oh, it's a wonderful question. We were really happy in a very sweet, committed, active congregation of very bright people in Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland, for anyone who lives on the coast and thinks that's all flyover country, is an amazing part of the country, an incredible Jewish community, has a deep culture of philanthropy, both Jewishly and secularly, which means that the sorts of cultural amenities there are top rate. And in many cases, they actually surpass the coast. The Cleveland Symphony beats out New York and L.A. regularly. It actually sometimes fights with Chicago for who's the top.
Really?
Yeah, people do not know this, and I can hear just from your voice, it's surprising. When I went to the museum, the main museum there, for the first time, my mouth just kept hitting the floor, because when I was in college, we had to take, you know, your core classes in the arts, and one of which was a survey class in modern art. And I'm walking through the halls there and the walls and saying, we have that? We have that? We have that? And it's like all of these were like these giant, world-famous paintings of the modernist period, surrealism, pointillism, what have you, because they have those sorts of resources. So Cleveland's amazing. We did not think we were leaving. We had committed because we'd had a lot of movement in our life. It was a great place to raise kids, and we're like, okay, this is it. And then one day, a friend who I should probably stay nameless, but might have worked here at one point, just reached out to me and let me know that this place was opening up. And I was walking from my office to the kitchen, and Laura's office, you know, Cleveland houses are bigger. And as I walked by, I just say, hey, Laura, Portland's open. Now, in a rabbinic family, that phrase, which could mean anything, right? Oh, were they closed for repairs? Right? Right? It means something different. Mm-hmm. And my wife is super, super careful with furniture and things, which is why this next detail is important. I suddenly hear the legs of her chair scraping across the floor, and she walks over. There's like three steps up, so she's looming over me, and she says, Portland, that's my fantasy place to live.
Really?
Which, for some reason, I had no idea. When we were living in the Bay Area, we had friends who had escaped the Bay Area, the whole tech boom and, you know, tech bubble and how that changed
escaped
that city.
Escaped to Portland,
and
made
it,
yeah.
Exactly.
There's an entire culture around it.
Exactly. So we had come up and a long, long time ago now. And went to a movie theater where they served beer and pizza, which was like the, I mean, that was ground zero. Nobody, like, you got popcorn or your bupkis, right? Nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was not what made her fall in love. But it was just, you know, it was.
It didn't hurt.
It didn't hurt. I mean, we're not beer drinkers, really. But in any case, it was just, you know, that alternative weird, keep Portland weird sort of thing. It was just a cool, quirky town back then. And she'd remembered that. And apparently that was her thought. Part of that fantasy was also we never imagined, given what we do for work, that we'd be able to afford the West Coast again, which is where Laura's from. But when you think about California real estate prices, et cetera, that's mm-hmm. a whole lot better if you are in Silicon Valley. I've known attorneys and high-paid medical professionals who can't afford to live there. So, you know, all the more so, as you say, alachat kama v'chama for, you know, a rabbinic, a rabbi and a therapist. But so this was our chance to get back to the West Coast. And then we began just to research it and see whether it would be a good fit for us.
I was planning to follow that up with what really drew you to the rabbinate, but it sounds like there was just a wake up and a moment of clarity, and it was a pretty linear track from there to rabbinical school.
Well, it wasn't. So, I mean, it's a great question. It was not a linear track, and I think this is actually useful for listeners, because sometimes in the popular media, you know, movies about a near-death experience or whatever, that people return and they have total focus and they don't have any questions about their lives because they came that close with a brush with death and realize how precious life is. Maybe there's some people like that, but I don't think that's how life actually works. So the moment I had a week of, I was totally blissed out. I thought, oh, this is what nirvana or sudden enlightenment is like.
Yeah.
So really, there was like no pain, just pure like bliss for that week. But then I'm a human being, right? The doubts, who am I to do this and what's involved or where? So yeah, no, there was a, in hindsight, it was linear. The experience of it was not linear.
What were some of the things that really motivated you to keep following that path, even when those doubts popped up?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, because we all have those doubts. For me, it was fidelity to that epiphany. And I think that there's always an element of choosing, right? For anyone who's been married for any length of time, right? You may love your spouse, you may like your spouse, you may be angry with your spouse. Nonetheless, each day you wake up and there's a sort of a recommitment. So there's a fidelity, in that case, to that moment under the chuppah or however one got married, that keeps that relationship alive. So there has to be a moment or a value, if you're doing this from a positive reason, not from a fear-based reason, that is sufficient in itself that you maintain that fidelity and loyalty to it. It becomes an organizing principle in your life, right? So you share with me your desire and interest as a, you know, being quite young with photography, and here you still are with that, right? So there's certain things that they open something for us, and then we stay with it. So I think that's the answer you're asking about.
That's beautifully said. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So what are some of the moments in your tenure here that are the most memorable for you?
Some of them I don't want to share, because oftentimes there's a level of confidence involved in this work. So certain moments just in this office, pastorally, at people's deathbeds in hospital, seeing people transition, those moments are really indelible, and they're also private. There's a certain intimacy to them. On a programmatic level, I was really proud of the work we did with our Soup to the Street program, which ran until the pandemic, and that just kiboshed so much of our lives. Yeah. And after the pandemic, it still didn't quite feel right. But during that period, I would have congregants come to my house. We would cook 10 gallons of soup. We had these insulated Cambro containers. That's a plug. Let's get some financing from them for that brand placement.
By
yeah, exactly. We would make sandwiches. We got bread donated. For one point, there's a baker. He also didn't survive the pandemic, but this was a recovering alcoholic who had, like many alcoholics, hurt a lot of people in his life. And so what he had wanted to do was to make bread, which is so fundamental and basic, as a way of giving back to the world. So he had a little bakery out west of here and sold it, but he gave us the bread for that each time we were doing Soup to the Streets for free. And just meeting so many of, you know, unhoused Portlanders who represent a really wide swath of life. I mean, for me, one of my social action sort of arenas that's always motivated me was dealing with the homeless, houseless, whatever you want to say these days, because it is a category that cuts across almost all of society's divisions, right? If you're looking at a particular ethnicity or whatever, that's sort of self-exclusionary, but the homeless are women and men and non-binary people, often non-binary people whose parents haven't been able to deal with that, and they end up on the street. Rich and poor, you think, how do the rich end up on the streets? But drugs can claim people and estrange them, young and old, educated and uneducated, black, white, Asian, it doesn't matter. And so I've always sort of thought about, if you want to see what a society is really about, look at how it treats the least of them. And in this case, the least of them is not an other. It's an us, and there we are with this problem of affordability in this country.
I want to go back a moment real quick, and without delving into specifics and honoring that level of confidentiality you spoke of, what really What were the feelings that you had in some of those moments you mentioned, like privately in this office or at deathbeds or in those transition moments? What about those? Obviously, they're meaningful for the people that are going through them, and I'm certain it's meaningful to have their rabbi there with them. What about those kinds of experiences is meaningful for you being with someone else in their moments?
I think that our society, maybe most societies, but certainly our society demands that we don a coterie of masks, that we have to learn how to present ourselves, be smooth, not declare ourselves, what have you. Everybody, in some degree, has to have a chameleon sort of life in this world. But there are these moments in life where our fragility, our vulnerability, our frailty makes us face the world without those masks. And it is an honor and a privilege and a teaching moment to get to witness those. So you get to see a person in his, her, their deepest reality. What a privilege.
Yeah. I think that's as good of a billboard ad for pulpit rabbinical work as I can think of off the top of my head.
Well, good. We need that. As you are aware, there's a shortage of people who want to go in and do this work. It's demanding in so many ways. It's a self-sacrificial mode of being. We're not in an era that highlights that as the way to the good life, right? We're about work-life balance or, you know, self-actualization or whatever. So we do, hopefully, as trends in society change, that will also change, and we'll see the seminaries, we'll see people knocking on the doors of the seminaries again.
Forget Cambro. This should be sponsored by rabbinical schools.
I'll let you do the legwork for that, but I can give you a name or two if you're looking.
Excellent. So in your 10 years here, how has this congregation, Neve Shalom, changed in your view?
You know, there's a part of that question that I can answer and a part I can't. And this is also, I think it's true for every human being. It is certainly true for people who end up filling a sort of key personnel role. I don't know what the community was like before I was inserted into it. And I mean that not just in a historically, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. But when someone is in a key personnel role, that role means that their presence changes the system, right? Not because they're so wonderful or not wonderful, whatever, just that role is an organizing principle. So I don't know how and what this community was like, but what I can say and has been a really important functional value for me is a certain sort of openness to inclusion of and culture which makes space for different sorts of people. That showed up as much through Israel 360 and the Kindness Commons, our attempt to allow people to have very different opinions on Israel, which they did, but to feel heard and respected along the way. So a lot of my public speaking or writing has touched on social issues of the day, but has not been political in a small p way. I mean, I haven't avoided it because the Torah has something to say about how we live. But I've tried to really apply a Torah lens, an honest Torah lens, where I'm looking at the tradition as a whole. And that means that it's very hard to tie down any particular moment and connect it to left or right or center politically. Judaism's lens gives us usually a very different perspective on it. Mm-hmm. Because, among other things in Judaism, there are very few absolutes. There are three things, for example, in which we don't follow the precept of saving a life, a pikuach nefesh, of a life takes precedence above all, which you'd think would be as close to an ultimate value as you'd have in Judaism. But even that has limits, including blaspheming God's name, which is not what people would necessarily say, but then the more obvious, like, don't take another person's life. But all that's just a way of saying that Judaism is very much interested in situational ethics and not grand or simple moral statements of right or wrong. We have those in there, but it's very balanced. So when that's my hashkafa, my Jewish perspective on the world and how I operate on it. Even when I was the captain of my high school ultimate frisbee team, I was operating on that principle. But what that meant was that there are people of all walks of life who I think, hope, felt like they were comfortable here. And I've certainly been told in a city like Portland, where there are people on the political right, they often felt like they've had to disguise who they are in the Jewish community. I find this very sad, but it is true, because the dominant culture of this area is to be on the left side of the political spectrum, often to demonize those on the right, so that we have plenty of Jews. I don't know what the percentage is. I mean, clearly the majority in Portland does lean left. But within that sizable minority, many people have told me that it was the first time they felt safe or could be themselves, or that they weren't isolated, right? And that's because that particular way. So I think, you know, when I think about the culture that I've contributed to, that is a valuable piece to me. And I think it created a Big Tent culture, which is one of the names for conservative Judaism.
And you may have the same caveat for this question as the last one, but how have you noticed the broader Jewish community in Portland change in your time here?
Well, I want to link this a little bit. I know we're heading towards the future of Judaism, both in Portland and nationally. So one of the things that we now know, and I think this is really important, is that Americans are returning to religion. The pendulum has swung. And the pendulum I grew up in, right, was very much influenced, you know, free my generation, but influenced by the hippies and the boomers and all those who were trying to move away from maybe a too rigid expression of religious identity in America, whatever you have. I'll leave the sociologists to define exactly what that was. So there was a lot of rejectionism, a desire to create something new, also very, very American. David Brooks, who's an interesting centrist New York Times columnist, had just talked about how, you know, the promise of the secular world was that it would supply the meaning needed to feel like your life was valuable. Ultimately, that collapsed. It didn't do that for all sorts of complicated reasons beyond the scope of this particular discussion that we're having here. And as a consequence of that, that long pendulum swing of half a century, I guess, really, where people were moving away from religion, seems to be changing.
And you've noticed that even here in Portland, which is famously one of the least religious cities in the U.S.
Exactly. And so, and it may well be that because there are, you know, this is the most unchurched city. Nobody says unsynagogued. It's a weird sounding. But maybe it's easier to see that change because there's fewer dots on the graph, if you will. We have, you know, the clergy team has been involved in so in welcoming so many Jews of choice into this community over the decade. And it has grown. I don't want to give false numbers. I don't have them off the top of my head. But it has grown incredibly. Even after October 7th, that actually confirmed some people's desire for that. So one of the changes, right, is that people who were not Jewish by birth are seeking that religion, are seeking a larger transpersonal narrative of meaning and connection. That's also true, though, for many people who are Jews, right? If, again, we go back to the 1950s, 60s, the boomer generation, the beatniks, all of that, the move away from religion, right, and the rejection of it, those people had a bubby and a zeta, Ashkenazic terms for, you know, their grandparents from the old world. They had that culture. And even when they rejected it, they were deeply permeated by this. Then they raised their kids who didn't have it. And then the next generation is coming up, and they didn't have a bubby or zeta. They didn't have even the cultural trappings of Judaism. In a certain sense, they were starting from nothing. What the Gemara, the Talmud talks about, you know, atinok shenish badame. They're like little babies who are born from nothing, and they want to reclaim and recover a Jewish journey. That is a question we started with. Their Jewish identity, they want to explore it and what it means. So you have people who are hungry for this sort of meaning and community and experience. That's really different. So that's the rabbinical or rabbi or religious sort of answer to how I've seen things change. We all know how much sociologically and economically, even politically, this city has changed. We moved here when Portland was having this beautiful moment in the sun. Everything was going up. It was the desired location. Everyone wanted to move to Portland. Net growth of population each month was high. We saw the run-up to housing, which has only exacerbated our housing crisis that we're crises that we have here. But it was the great city to move to, right, for, you know, small, mid-sized city, you know, going up. And in the intervening decade, all of that's disappeared. We've been set back. I don't know how many decades we've been set back. But Portland, you know, fell apart in a lot of ways. George Floyd was a terrible moment in American history. And again, as someone who's not really ascribing myself politically one way or the other, who went downtown, we had riots and we had protests, both simultaneously in the same space, right? So it wasn't one or the other. But that moment, that pregnant moment where America was asking itself again, have we made any progress on race relations or any of it, was, I wouldn't say it was the straw that broke the camel, but it was like a telling moment of change in the city. We saw the breaking of store windows, which was not just like people of rage. It was a statement that this downtown, which is supposed to represent a city, actually doesn't represent us. Rightly or wrongly, right? It was a way in which people were injuring themselves without necessarily doing that. When you throw a rock through a private individual's jewelry shop, for example, it's not a big corporation. It's a person trying to make a way in the world for their family, and you're throwing it at yourself, right? And a really concrete example of that, this congregation's had a number of people in pawn shops, right? In fact, one of our congregants whose deathbed I was on, going back to that, actually set up a whole system of ethics and an organization for ethical conduct for pawn shop owners. But pawn shops for those on the lower end of the economic class are the bank of last resort or the only bank that they actually trust. They don't trust Citibank or U.S. Bank and what have you.
Yeah.
We won't get brand placement from those banks now.
Probably
from that,
not.
Right? And yet, during those protests and riots, one of those pawn shops downtown was destroyed twice. So it's not just like some theoretical or pretty thing you're throwing a rock at yourself, which I think is true. They literally were. As if once wasn't enough, right? So we saw this complete breakdown on what does it mean to be a city, to have a common public square, a belief that there was no such thing. The defund the police movement had a huge, forget the dollar amount of it, had a huge impact on police morality, and many people who were officers of the law who could left because they were demoralized, and they'd gone into it to try to do good, and now they were suddenly viewed as the boogeyman, and so they stepped out. And my friends from my interfaith work, Portlanders of color, were in the neighborhoods that most relied on the police to maintain order and safety, and their neighborhoods were destroyed. So there was this way in which the polarization in the city was hurting, in some degree, the people who were meant explicitly to help, but we've all suffered. So Portland has had those issues. It's had a paralysis of impact with its city governing structure, and I hope with the new model that we'll begin to see more responsiveness. But a lot of people don't want to go downtown. A lot of people don't feel good about the city, and that's, again, really bad for all of us. So, you know, it may be indicative of the country as a whole, but the great story of American progress or hope or improvement disappeared. And I think that's also part of the reason for that return to religion, right? That if the social forms that are supposed to hold us and help us aren't working, where do I find the support I need for my life? And religion has been, I don't think of it as a panacea for the people or opiate for the people in Freudian or Marxian sort of a approach or way, but as another source of meaning, because we're not just physical beings. We also, we think, we care, we feel, and we need answers to those issues also. That was really long-winded. I'm sorry.
It's very insightful, though, as well. And it bleeds right into my next question. What are your hopes? What would you like to see for the future of both this congregation and the larger community in which it exists?
So if the pendulum has swung, first maybe on religion, but then also will Portland get its mojo back, right, which I certainly hope. Then the question is, how does this community build on a felicitous moment in time? And Atretson, as the tradition would say, people are coming back to religion, but we know in the past they left religion. Why did they leave religion? Because religion became fossilized. It became static. It became self-congratulatory on its forms. So the challenge will be if we begin to grow again, and we've been very fortunate here. We've grown throughout over the last 10 years, which bucked the national trend. When I came here, I think we had about 750 family units, and we're about 850 in an era where the old line was flat is the new up. So we've been up during those times. So there's always success carries a double-edged sword, and is always really dangerous because it can invite a sort of spiritual complacency. I grew up in the era where American cars were dominant. They stopped investing, and Detroit destroyed itself out of greed and complacency. I'm not saying that that trend is happening here at all. I don't think that is the case. But I know there's always a danger that success makes people sleepy at the wheel, right? So what does that mean? It means, among other things, figuring out radical new approaches to Jewish living that make sense for a 21st century AI-infused sociology. I don't know what it means, right? But I think this is a moment of tremendous opportunity for Neve Shalom and for religious institutions. I think that assuming religious institutions avoid mistakes around the business of houses of worship, meaning if the finances can be kept in check and taken care of during, you know, a difficult time financially for, I mean, it's always a difficult time financially for nonprofits, mm-hmm. but, well, you know, even more so if the structure, the business structure around it can be avoided from going downhill, there's no reason this congregation should not grow, right? And so that's really exciting. And the question always is, what do we do with that growth? It's a question America, now moving to the America question that you asked, that we always struggle to answer, right? We know that America in many criteria is richer than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. And we also know that the inequities around that richness are really, really big and creating a lot of problems. So how do we distribute all this stuff, this change? How do we take whatever it is that AI can bring and make sure that it's not just a disruptor which puts a lot of people out of jobs, but allows us to move a little bit closer to, you know, Reagan's shining city on the hill, in America that is inspiring and that really does work for everyone? Because, you know, from the progressive era through the early 60s, everyone's boat in America was rising. And then starting mid to late 60s, it's been going the other way nonstop. You can read the book, The Upswing, with lots of charts and graphs all about this. So that's my hope, is that America can figure out again that there's only this one country and collective, that it's always been composed of people from many different walks of life and backgrounds, and that the social contract for America is that the success of all guarantees the success of the individual. So I hope that we can figure that out. We're in a time of tremendous turbulence. We know that our political structures, how politics is done, all of these things are changing at rapid pace. And I hope we can find our way. You know, if anyone who's a student of history knows, there's no guarantees that powerful countries remain that way. And I think America, for all of its good and all of its bad, I think that the American experiment still has what to offer the world, let alone its own citizens. So I really hope that with this pendulum swing and readjustment, that we find a way that some middle path that allows all Americans to have more opportunity.
Looking back on your 10 years here, is there anything you'd want to do differently if you got another run at it?
Oh, my goodness. You know, when I was a kid, I really loved that English sci-fi comedy show, Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. I say comedy because it's also shtick. It's not comedy per se. Yeah, I mean, like, who would not like to go backwards in time? The thing is that it's a weird little game, because as soon as you change one feature, the rest of the picture would also change. So, I mean, I wish I had pushed the community harder than I did to develop different forms of revenue. Synagogues are funded. About half of revenue is provided by the dues structure. And then the other half, which means, by the way, I periodically like to say this, anyone who's involved in Jewish life and feels it's so expensive needs to remember they're already being subsidized with a 50%, or, you know, they'd have to double their dues to pay the actual cost of involvement. The primary people say, okay, then I really don't want to be involved. But no, that's not what I'm, that's not what I'm saying. So I think that, you know, I wish I had been able to help us grow more in creating different sorts of revenue streams. Right, we finally started offering chalot, challah breads, in the foundation school for families. That's something, it's within our mission. It's a little bit of income, but it's another stream. So we need the resources. It's an economically challenging time. Whether the next generation will be able to give charitably in the way that earlier generations did in a city whose culture is not about philanthropy overall, that's not a this on Portland, that's just a statement of fact, and coming from Cleveland before here, which is a very different culture, that's a real challenge for all of our not-for-profit ventures. So, yeah, I wish I had been able to move us more in that way so that there'd be an even firmer fiscal footing to continue the growth that we can expect.
So what's next for you?
You know, there's. I'll give the easy answer in a second, and it's certainly the one I've been sharing. Nobody knows what's next for them, right? man plans and God laughs is the old Yiddish statement. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
That's not the easy answer?
Well, no, that's actually the hard answer because it requires a certain humility. I don't know what's coming. But we're moving to the country, moving off-grid. My wife will continue doing her therapy and develop some more intensive models so people can move through their life challenges more effectively, and that's going to be fantastic. It's a very healing area, a piece of land. And I'm going to be working on books and writing and developing my own Jewish meditation practice. Last night, from when this podcast is being recorded, was sort of the spring fundraiser, and I was the honoree as I planned to leave. So I gave a talk, and one of the lines in my talk, which I think is valuable for all of us to hear, is that a lot of times we think of time as a means to an end, right? Time is what we use. It's a tool to achieve our goals. And that's fine. Simultaneously, if we want a taste of God, if we want a taste of infinity, if we want to get grounded in the deeper currents of life, we also need to experience time as an ends, as a value in and of itself, not something that we do with, but something that we experience as it is. And certainly for Judaism with Shabbat, that's built in, right? We're supposed to have that. But I think lots of us, if we're honest, we're still doing a lot of stuff like on Shabbat. And I don't mean like not Shabbat stuff. I just mean, are we really just sitting and looking at a flower, right? I mean, are we stepping into time as its own experience? So I've been working since I was 14 years old. You know, I raked lawns and mowed lawns and shoveled snow back east. We tried a lemonade stand once or twice, but it wasn't a very good decision financially. Particularly as my mom, who grew up in the Depression, made sure that we had to pay for the lemons and the sugar. So we didn't get free costs.
She wanted to teach you about supply chain.
She did. It was awesome, and we learned that. So you couldn't really charge enough for lemonade and still make any money off of it. So, yes, I've been working a long time. And I'm going to be dedicating myself to writing, but I also think that as a spiritual person, as a rabbi, creating a envelope around myself in which I can have more moments in which time is an ends and not a means is what I require at this moment. And I, in part with the writing, I hope to be able to share that with people, because even those who aren't in a position in their lives to experience time as an ends rather than a means. People have to work two jobs, or families with young children, someone with a chronic illness, right? There's a lot of situations, externals, where it's very hard to do that, but we still have that hunger for it, and we need to know about it and know it's a possibility, even if we aren't able to get there ourselves. So I want to, I need that for myself. And I think I can also share that with people so that they're reminded. In the same way, you have a lot of millennials and folks who are saying, you know, the city is not, I no longer want to build my life around the city and the career. And so people are moving to smaller towns and places. I think this is part of that rebalancing that the country is doing. And part of it is to get to experience time rather than just fill it.
Well, I'm going to be chewing on that thought for a while. How would you like to be remembered? How would you like your time at this congregation to be remembered?
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to go down that rabbit hole. I come from a family of legacy, right? I have this inheritance of family history. But to ask for it from your own labors is a really strange form of vanity. When I was living in Cleveland, I met a older gentleman once, and he had been in the construction business and built a lot of homes and buildings and things. I said, that has to feel really kind of cool when you're driving through town and seeing, you know, the work of your hands and knowing that's going to live on. I said, oh no, most of the things I built have been torn down. So there you have something that is like so tachless, so fundamental. You'd think like a building would be around forever, and many are. Our house is up here is from 1947, but there's a certain illusion in there, or ego, as though knowing that we've had some sort of impact makes our life significant. You know, that's not for me to say how I'll be remembered. That's for other people to sort of figure out what their interactions with me have yielded for them. So I'll let someone else answer that question.
That is the most illuminating non-answer I can think of, so thank you.
I'm not trying to avoid it. I mean, I really think that's the fairest, most honest answer I know.
That's all I could ask.
No.
After 10 years at this synagogue, what's something that your congregants might not yet know about you?
Oh, wow. You know, it's the danger when you have to speak publicly and write and share messages all the time is actually, do I have any stories that I haven't shared yet? Right? You know, I mean, that's why I like talking to other people. I know my own shtick so well that, you know, I don't know. A bizarre little story comes up. In part because when we get to this little piece of land, we want to grow some vegetables and have that sort of thing. When we were in Cleveland, I built with my father-in-law a garden box. There were deer there. We had to bend metal piping and make a mesh cover for this garden box to keep the deer out. And so by the time we finished this, in not the sunniest climate, we were able to grow cherry tomatoes, which I would like to say were some of the most mediocre $50 cherry tomatoes I've ever tasted. Right? We spent hundreds on the wood, on the soil, on the metal frame, and we got bupkis out of it. So, no, I don't think anyone knows that. But, yeah, I feel for the farmers. I clearly can't do that for a living.
Well, you'll have some time to practice, it sounds like.
Indeed, yeah.
Well, mazel tov on your tenure here, and best wishes for that which comes next, up to and including your gardening. Rabbi David Kosak, thank you so much for joining us.
Rachni, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me here and for sitting down for this conversation. Appreciate you.
That's all for this episode of the Jewish Review Podcast. Many sincere thanks and best wishes for the next chapter to Rabbi David Kosak. He'll be succeeded as Neva Shalom Senior Rabbi by Rabbi Eve Posen, who you can hear talk about Hanukkah and Hanukkah pajamas in Managing Many Merriments, the 8th episode in this season of the podcast. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice to help others find our show. Click subscribe to get our latest episode every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you really want to show your support, your gift to the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland's annual Campaign for Community Needs makes this podcast, our community newspaper, and so much of the work we cover possible. Learn more and make your contribution today at jewishportland.org/give. As a note for our loyal regular listeners, our next episode will be delayed a week while we polish off the last of the cheesecake from Shavuot. The next episode of the Jewish Review Podcast will be released on June 25th, with a return to our regular bi-weekly schedule thereafter. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. Don't forget, you can get the latest news from Portland's Jewish community by subscribing to the Jewish Review online for free at jewishportland.org/podcast. Jewish Review. The Jewish Review podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Karone Blau-Rothstein. Assistant editor is Rachel Nelson. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, all the best.